My name is Avery Ruffin, and you're listening to The Nancy Ruffin Show.
You are tuned in to The Nancy Ruffin Show, a digital global classroom where individuals across all ages, backgrounds, and career levels tune in for guidance and motivation to live life on their own terms. Hosted by award-winning author, transformation coach, and the self-proclaimed Latina Oprah, The Nancy Ruffin Show is where inspiring thought leaders, modern-day influencers, and social game changers come to discuss their own personal journeys and have real conversations about the journey to success. It's where the next generation of leaders come to tap into their potential, ignite their fire, and expand their self-awareness. So if you're ready to power up and blaze trails of positive change, then you're in the right place. Let's get started. Welcome back to another episode of The Nancy Ruffin Show. It's your girl, Nancy Ruffin, and you are tuned in to the number one personal development podcast where we develop tomorrow's leaders today. Yes, that is the goal, the purpose, the promise of this podcast. It means that I am committed to sharing with all of you the knowledge, resources, wisdom, tools that I have acquired on my own personal and professional development journey. And we share the stories of others who have achieved success in their own way, in their own industries, as a way and as a tool to help you on your own journey. So with that being said, I hope you guys had an amazing weekend. I hope that today you are ready to step into the day and into the week focused, re-energized, and just committed to being consistent and dedicated to whatever you set your mind to. I will tell you that you get to a place of feeling successful, not by wishing for it, not by praying for it, but by dedicating yourself to whatever it is that you want to achieve every single day. It's about being committed. It's about being consistent. It's about having a clear focus on what it is you want to achieve, and understanding the things that you are willing to sacrifice in order to get there. And yes, I said the word sacrifice because I think that for anybody who wants to achieve anything, there are certain things that we have to sacrifice. And for some of us, that may be time, it may be money, it may be that vacation, you know, that we want to take, but maybe we shouldn't take it right now because we have to stay focused on the work that we're doing. You know, any kind of success requires sacrifice. And until you are willing to sacrifice something, you're never really going to get to where you want to go. This past weekend, this month actually has been a super busy month for me. I've had almost back-to-back events for the past, we're only maybe 2 weeks into this month, and I've had back-to-back events for the past 2 weeks. The first one being was my keynote speech at the Federal Bureau of Investigation. It was an amazing opportunity to be there. Sometimes I stay in awe of the doors that have opened for me, but then when I take a moment to just reflect, I'm not surprised, because I have remained consistent and committed and dedicated to this work that I do. And when you're committed and consistent, people start to recognize that. People see that. And people will reach out to you because they want to bring you in. And this is how we elevate ourselves. This is how we elevate our work. You have to be true to the work. You have to be true to the work. It's no easy straight line path to success. And sometimes we achieve things that were never really on our goals list to begin with. Because I will tell you that throughout my entire career, being a keynote speaker for the FBI was never a goal. It was never a desire. It wasn't anything that I ever committed myself to doing or achieving. And yet when the opportunity presented itself, I felt successful. It was rewarding. It was fulfilling. And so sometimes in the work that we're doing, the recognition and the accolades that we get as a result of that is just a bonus. So thank you to the FBI for inviting me, for having me back and allowing me to talk a little bit about what it means to me to be Latina, about my culture, about my history, about my struggles. They really just gave me the opportunity to share my story. And so thank you. Then after that event, then I did the 100 Hispanic Women Mind, Body, Spirit Conference. It was an all-day conference. Over 100 Latina professionals in the same room for a day of wellness. It was getting ourselves right, mind, body, and spirit. And I was able to participate in two panels. I was able to lead a workshop. And it's something to be able to be in these spaces with women who look like you, with women who share many of the same experiences, and yet know that these are all professional women. These are doctors, they're CEOs, they're CFOs, they're in leadership positions. And it's great to be in that room and be able to celebrate each other in that way. And also, it's able to be able to connect with the younger generation, right? And it allows them to see women who look like them and come from where they come from succeeding, right? And this is what we all should be striving for. We should be striving to be that representation for the generations coming behind us. And then lastly, the last event that I just participated in over the weekend was the Propel and Purpose Conference. This one was great because it was really aligned with where I currently am in my own life and in my own journey. And it's about using my own experiences, using my business and all of the work that I do, and really tying it back to God and how God has been the central force in my life, in my success, and everything that I've been able to achieve, and being able to share my story and linking those two things in a room with other women just really left me feeling full. I just have to give a quick shout out to Charlotte Nader for being the brains behind the event. She had this idea, she put it together. It was really about talking how we propel in our purpose, how we discover that purpose, what do we do when we are called to our purpose. She had a beautiful moment where she also honored Genesis, and that is the sister of Junior, the young man who was killed last year on a Bronx street because of mistaken identity. And if you've been paying any attention to the news, you know that this week, the five men that were involved in his murder got sentenced to life in prison. So sometimes the justice system does work. Amen. But in any case, she was the honored guest, and Charlene really just honored her bravery, how courageous she has been, her strength, and how she is going to be stepping into her own purpose, and how God is going to use these experiences, as tragic as they were, as heart-wrenching as it was. I think that everyone everywhere felt the loss of her brother. I personally remember I went to the site where he was murdered. When they were having a vigil, I prayed over the site. I prayed for him. I prayed for her. I prayed for his family. Because it's hard to not put yourself in that situation and feel what that family must have been feeling like. And so she honored her. It was a beautiful moment. I was just really honored and excited to be a part of an amazing panel of powerhouse women who are all really stepping into their purpose and just glorifying God in all of the work that they do. So there's been just so many things happening, all good things, right? I've been booked, busy, blessed. But, you know, a consequence of being booked and busy and blessed is that I'm tired. Exhausted. But I do look forward for the next couple of weeks, just taking a break and relaxing. My next event is not until the end of this month. October 26th, which is the Grow Your Vision event that I am hosting as part of my organization, The Fierce Woman, along with my amazing program coordinator, Jessica Martinez. We have been working just really hard to put together an amazing event that is centered on helping you grow in your career, in your business, in your brand, and whatever area in your life that you want to grow, and you want to be able to do so through digital marketing, through social media, through having web presence. I have an amazing lineup of panelists who have been able to do this for themselves, and they're going to come and they're going to share all of their secrets. They're going to share how they did it. They're going to share their struggles, their challenges, how they were able to overcome those things. They're going to also share the tools that they use, their resources. I mean, if you really want to level up and you want to get to that next level in your own life, then this is an event that I encourage you to be at. We're going to have food, we're going to have drinks, we're going to have sweet treats, we're going to have swag bags for those who purchase VIP tickets. It's going to just be a really great day. It's happening October 26th in Chelsea from 12 to 5 p.m. There are still tickets available. So if you are interested in attending, make sure you head over to www.growyourvision.eventbrite.com. Now, one more thing I want to share. October is the month of a lot of things happening. Between September 15th, October 15th, we know that it's Hispanic Heritage Month. We also know that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and it's also Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So this month we're highlighting, you know, a lot of these causes. I know so many people who have been affected by breast cancer. And, you know, if you've been listening to the podcast regularly, you know that I shared my own breast cancer awareness story as a result of an abnormal mammogram. I recently had breast surgery to have a mass removed. Thank God that it was non-cancerous. But had I not found it, when I did, had I been unaware, had I just left it there, my doctor said that it could have turned into cancer. It could have grown. It could have metastasized. You know, so early detection is key. So to my ladies, and my men, because breast cancer can happen to men as well, I implore you, go get these mammograms. Early detection is best. If you can catch it early, your survival rate is that much higher. I know that it can be scary to go and get one. I know that you've heard that it's painful. I will tell you that I personally did not experience any pain. It's a bit uncomfortable, I'm not gonna lie, but it doesn't last for more than 5 seconds. Honestly, they put your breast on the plate. Yes, they put some pressure, they squish it up in there, but then that's like 5 seconds. They take the picture and then they release it and then you're done. That simple. And that little thing can save your life. So if you've been prolonging it, like I was, I'm 42. I should have had my first mammogram by the time I was 40, and I did not. I waited 2 years to have mine. And who knows how long I had that mass there. But I got it removed, and thank God I'm okay. But there's so many women, you know, who die from breast cancer, and you don't want to be a part of that statistic. So make sure that you go and you get yourself tested, get your boobies checked out, plain and simple. So let's get into this week's podcast. This week, I'm really excited because I was able to sit down with two women who have really dedicated and committed their lives to bringing and spreading awareness around human trafficking, around what that is, how it can happen right underneath our own noses within our communities, and the various ways that people get trafficked. Right, a lot of times we think that it's just for sexual exploitation, but human trafficking is also happening, through employment, through labor, having people work basically for free or for really low wages. So it was a very, very interesting and necessary conversation. And, you know, if you remember this year when I covered the Puerto Rican Day Parade, one of the causes that we were highlighting was human trafficking as in collaboration with the Ricky Martin Foundation. And so this is really just a continuation of that conversation. I think that it's important for you to listen. Encourage someone else to listen to this, because you never know when you can be in a restaurant, you can be getting served by someone who's being human trafficked. And it happens all around us. So a part of being vigilant is being aware. So when we come back from the break, I'm going to get right in to the conversation with Maribel Rivera and Shauna Peterson, who are my guests. And they're going to be talking about the work that they do with the Life Preservers Project. So sit tight and we'll be right back.
You are now listening to the one and only Nancy Ruffin.
Welcome back, guys. Thank you for tuning in to another week of the Nancy Ruffin Show. This week, joining me, I have two very special women, one of whom is a personal friend of mine, and she is heavily involved in giving back to her community in so many different ways. So I am not surprised that she is a part of this project. We're going to be speaking about the importance of bringing awareness to human trafficking, and how this has turned into not just a crisis in New York City, but it's really a global crisis. And my guests tonight, Shauna Peterson and Maribel Rivera, are really on the forefront of this movement here in New York City. So without further ado, welcome, ladies.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you for having us.
I'm so just grateful that you ladies are here. Thank you for joining and giving of your time. I know how valuable time is in this day and age, how busy everyone is. So thank you. And I really want to just get right into it, because I think that this is a really important discussion, one that I don't think we have enough of in our communities. So I really just want to get right into it. But before we do so, I want to give you all an opportunity to introduce yourselves, let the audience know a little bit about who you are, some of the work that you do, and what really brought this this project into your lives, and why is it important, an important mission for you, both of you, to kind of stand behind. And whoever wants to go first, just jump right ahead.
I'll go first. Again, my name is Shauna Peterson, and I'm the founder and president of Life Preservers, Inc., Life Preservers Project. And we started about 10 years ago. I have a background in art. I have a bachelor's in fine art. I grew up in the music and art scene in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's where I first got introduced to the differences between street work, sex work, and trafficking. In the New Mexico area, there was a pretty big bust, human trafficking bust, at actually our favorite Chinese food restaurant that we used to go to every day at lunch in high school. So that was sort of my first introduction to the fact that even happened here in the States. And then if you fast forward about 10 years, I was living here in New York and was asked to help with a small fundraiser in Brooklyn for a friend of ours that was opening up a halfway house, which eventually became Restore New York, which is one of the leading halfway houses in New York right now, one of two really New York City-based halfway houses. So we were trying to raise money for Faith through this little art auction in Bushwick, and it didn't go well. We were all starving artists, we're all in art school, we didn't make her any money. But I realized at that moment that I worked in the legal industry, and I had a significant amount of influence and a pretty large network in the legal industry because I'm a legal recruiter. I knew people at the director and partner level throughout the city. And it occurred to me that I could combine my art network, my art contacts, my love of being an artist into a collective, and then leverage my network and the legal community to raise money and and influence in and education and just, you know, really all the things that being in the legal community can give. Just kind of this massive trifecta, right, of money, influence, and knowledge. So we started small. We had, you know, our first big event, our first annual event. It was tiny but fun 10 years ago. And ever since then, we have just grown exponentially through the good grace of all of the volunteers and the board and the corporate industry, legal industry here in New York.
That's pretty impressive. You know, it's interesting because when I was doing the research for this episode, I was wondering, like, how does art and law tie into this? But now I get it. You have a background in art, and you also work in the legal industry. So now that makes a lot of sense, because these are not two industries that would normally go together.
They wouldn't. You'd think they wouldn't. Yeah.
So it was really interesting. Well,
It's pretty funny because I think in our industry, what we find is there's a lot of people with different backgrounds who normally you wouldn't think, but they are in the legal industry, and we have a number of people, especially in the New York City area, Shauna, right? Who have degrees that are minors in or majors in art or theater or other things. So they do have these interesting, like, they graduated from college with all of these great degrees in,
right,
in, you know, in art, as artists or in theater as actors, but they're in the legal industry.
Right, right.
I mean, a great example is the head of my practice group at the law firm I work at. She has a BFA. She's actually an incredibly talented artist, and she contributed a piece to one of our auctions, not this year's, but last year's. And there was a collector there, completely unrelated, didn't know she was a partner, you know, a huge, you know, name partner in a law firm, who looks at Tessa's work and he says, wow, you know, she should probably consider getting a gallery. She could be really successful.
Look at that.
She really already is very successful as an attorney. And, you know, we've seen that the band who's performed for us tons of times, all legal industry folks. So it's really, there's an interesting tie-in. A lot of creatives went into law. Not something I expected, by the way, when I started this.
Well, you know, we never
crawled out.
Where the universe takes us, right? We start with one idea of what we think we're supposed to be doing, and then we kind of end up doing something totally different. But then eventually everything kind of ties back in. Everything connects in the end. Some way, somehow. So, Maribel, I want to give you an opportunity to introduce yourself as well. I don't want to just kind of get into the conversation without letting people know who you are.
So my name is Maribel Rivera. I am, I have my own marketing company. I focus mostly on the legal industry. So I've had my own marketing company for about almost 6 years now. I've had my own marketing company. I went out on my own after working with a lot of people who actually were, it was very difficult because I work in an industry that is male dominated. So I went out on my own after dealing with a lot of issues with men and diversity and other things that needed to be challenged. And so over the last 6 years, I've been very successful. I've had my own marketing company all this time. And so I focus mostly on the legal industry, but I do have clients that are in various other industries as well. So so you can say I'm a marketing consultant, and I do event management for a number of them as well, and sales operations consulting and other things. And I have to say, I am the first annual Fierce Woman.
Yes, you are.
Recipient.
You are.
So thank you. I was one of the first annual Fierce Women recipients, so I was very proud of that. It still sits on my desk in my home office. So I'm extremely proud of that. Coming from a Latina
organization. You're an amazing woman. And I'm just, first of all, I'm honored to even say that you're a friend and to just be a part of your life in any way. You're one of You're one of these rare women who really talks the talk when we're talking about what it means to support another woman, what it means, you know, to really stand behind the term woman empowerment. Like, you personify that, and not just the label, but in the way that you show up in the world for yourself and for other women. I remember when we first met and we were introduced by your husband, you know, he immediately thought that we should connect and get together. And I was like, okay. And from the moment that I met you, I mean, you just embraced me. I remember you attending, it was the very first Fierce Woman event I ever held, you know, and you came and yes. You showed up without really knowing anything about me, but you rolled up your sleeves and, you know, and you helped me launch, really. Like, you were the first, you know. And so from that moment, I always had a special appreciation for you. And then as I got to know you and I got to know more about your story and just the fierce woman that you are throughout the various stages of your life, the different challenges that you were faced and how you always came out on top. I mean, how can someone not acknowledge, you know, that and that kind of commitment and power? You know, and for me, you represented really what a fierce woman is. So yeah, of course you were going to be the first recipient of that award, honey.
So I am so proud of that award. It is probably something I'm more proud of than anything else, other than like anything my kids could ever come home with, or you know, that probably is second to any of that. But I have to say, yes, I am one of those women that I will, and Shauna could say no, because Shauna is one of my closest friends now, but I am one of those people that when they say, hey, can you help with this? How do we make this better? I am one of those people that jumps in and I say, okay, how do I help you? How do I help you make this extremely great? How do we get this so that everyone is talking about it? How do we make sure that people know what you're doing? Because I want to support women around me. I want to support the people around me. I want to, I was introduced to Shauna, 6-7 years ago, Shauna? Is it 6 or 7 years now?
Yeah, I think it was probably about, 6 or 7 years ago. Mike Cordoro was one of my top fundraiser people. He wasn't on the board yet. He was my fundraiser guy for Life Reservers. And he says to me, you got to meet Maribel. Nope, you can't. You're not doing this way anymore. And
yeah. He's
like, she's going to help us with our event. And this is one of our events at the Gansworth. And, you know, she just swooped in, didn't know me. I mean, we knew who each other was. We've been in staffing and in the industry together for years. We knew who each other were. And we were both, you know, at that time, at some way involved with Women Need Discovery as well. But she just swooped into that event without knowing me, took over. And we had just the most fabulous event. And then she made it very clear. I said this nasty habit of saying, all right, this is the last year. We're done. And that, so this is like year 4. And I was like, I'm done. I'm not doing anymore. And she's like, so at the end of the night, she's like, so I'm going to send you everything, all these spreadsheets. She's like, you need to start project plans. Set everything up on Google Docs. Like, everything's like, mind you, we had just met like 2 days earlier. Everything was set up in a database. Everything was there. And she's like, so now we're going to be ready for next year. And I was like, we're not doing next year. She's like, no. So anyway, we're going to do this. And all of a sudden, we had a project plan for the next year, and we do this every year with this song and dance every year. Yeah. And, so she went from being someone I didn't know who kind of swooped in the day or two before my event because Q was tired of me trying. Not that we weren't doing a great job on our own, but we needed marketing expertise and we needed project management expertise from an event side.
Right.
We all knew how to do it from the legal side. That just is not compute. So we're getting to the point in the size where, you know, law firm project managers, smart folks, absolutely not event managers. And so she took over, and sort of the rest is history, and became, she's like my sister to me. We fight, we laugh, we love. It's a really, so I can attest to her being, and when she says we're going to do something, we do it.
Right.
But the best thing about, and this isn't everything in life, by the way, if she says we're going to do it, I can fight, but we're going to do it. But what the best thing about Life Observers with her that I can test to, and like her kind of her fierceness, is a lot of people start trying to do what's called mission drift. And it's this thing where this could fit in with what we do and what our mission is. This could work. This could be a really cool idea. Let's do this. And people get all excited about it. And mission drift is very dangerous. And Maribel's very good at coming up with new ways of doing things and attaching them to the mission so that we're not drifting. For instance, the hurricanes in Puerto Rico, we decided to raise money for that. Now, that could seem like mission drift because it's a hurricane relief fund. But the reality is human trafficking spikes. Maribel comes to me, she's like, no, it's because human trafficking spikes. And we start talking about disaster trafficking and how that ties in. And so she was able to take this idea that a crucial thing that we had the resources and the power to raise money for and say, hey, you know what? Let's also focus on how this attaches to our mission. And that's something very unique she's brought to us. She talked me into teaching art. Doesn't sound like something that would be necessarily tied to the human trafficking fight. But it is, because I'm in the shelters working with either victims who might be trafficked right now or will be, could potentially be trafficked in New York. And so that's where her genius kind of has come in over the years, is finding ways to expand our organization and also stay on mission.
You know, I'm sitting here listening, and you, the things that you said about Maribel were the very same things that I just said about Maribel. And I think that that just goes to show, it speaks to her authenticity and really who she is, you know. And a lot of people, you know, they talk a lot, but when someone can describe you and then the next person can describe you in the very same way, I mean, I think that that says a lot. You know, because it's not about how you describe yourself, because we can say we're this, this, and that, but if our actions don't back up what we're saying, then it doesn't mean much. But here, Shauna, you and I have never personally met. Like, this is the first time we're speaking, and yet we both have had the same experience, you know, with Maribel. And I think that the way that you two have been able to come together in that way, and you're growing this very important organization, and for you to have the foresight to see where there was a need that you knew was missing and you were willing to fulfill, I think speaks a lot too about your leadership. Because sometimes, you know, when we're starting organizations, it's difficult for us to kind of let go of some of it, right? Because I think the fear is whoever we bring in may not be as passionate about the work as we are, as the one, you know, as you, the founder of this organization. And so I guess one of the things I want to talk to you specifically about is what were some of the greatest challenges you faced, you know, when you started Life Preservers? I mean, because any endeavor that requires the level of work that you're doing is going to be met with some challenges. So can you talk a little bit about what those were for you in the early stages?
Sure. Yeah. I guess there were a couple of big challenges. All of them come back to resources. I started out with this idea, as is my nature, I will have a big idea and I will dive headfirst into it without money. And so I came up with this idea to start Life Preservers Project. It was started to be one project. It was supposed to be October 10th, 2010. And I had the backing of the Times Square Business Alliance, the New York Times, and the Fashion District Alliance. And I had a gallery spot in Port Authority. So I went forward with what was supposed to be one event. I didn't need money because I had their help, but I did need to file a 501c3. I ended up filing that on my own. I drafted and filed it on my own with no attorney review. I was very blessed with, and everyone laughs, a very lovely lady at the IRS who spent like hours and hours and hours with me on the phone telling me how to do it right, and a corporate paralegal from Colgate-Palmolive who got the okay from the organization to help me file my state corporation documents. But we start out small, and the biggest thing, like I said, besides money, resources and money, is getting people, like you said, one of the hardest things getting people to commit. People will say they're going to do something.
Right.
People will tell you, I'm going to be on your board. I don't have anybody from the first founding board here anymore. Within about 6 months of my starting, my first board was gone and I got a new board. Luckily, one of the people is still, I don't know what he is. He says he's not on the board or whatever. My co-founder is still with the organization. And one of the other folks is, he was our opening act this year in the band. But basically, most of the people left, and that's because no one can commit. They have all these visions and ideas and thoughts and things they want to do. And it's very difficult because when you're trying to put something together and you can't rely on anybody, that becomes even more detrimental than a money thing. The third big problem, which I'm finally rectifying 10 years later, was there's a lot of old wives' tales about what a nonprofit can and cannot do. And there's Googling it doesn't help. Generally talking to other people, nonprofits doesn't typically help unless you know people who are in a big, like Oxfam-like organization. And so I didn't have the ability to have an executive director or anybody really in the organization who really knew nonprofit law. And it's incredibly nuanced and specific. And especially when you're dealing with art-related, collective-related things, there's gallery laws, there's all these things. I basically incorporated incorrectly initially and did not know what I was doing. And those things, you can run afoul very quickly of the IRS and the federal government. We didn't. Blessedly, for whatever reason, all of my direction ended up being correct. And we never did anything that did run afoul. But the realization that you can is very scary once you find out. It kind of started on a whim.
Right.
You don't really know how to run what is a business. It, though a nonprofit, is still a business and it has to be run like one. So those were my first 3 to 4 year stumbling blocks. Also, I work full time.
I
was actually in school full time the year I started it, that first year. I was still in college. I had a child. I worked full time. I still do, but it was also time. So it really is a resource crunch. It's nonprofits. You have to care about the subject matter. You have to have a personal connection generally to sustain something like that.
Both you and Maribel have these very full, lead these very full lives. And just you discussing some of, you know, I guess your initial challenges. And I think probably to some extent, the issue kind of with, you know, the board, that what might be an ongoing issue, right? Because you never know when someone is kind of ready to leave. You have to kind of always fill those voids. And I guess for the both of you, how do you manage to keep the same level of commitment and dedication to this work when you have so many other things in your wheelhouse that you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis? And so maybe, Maribel, maybe you could chime in here, and then Shauna, you can, you know, answer after her.
So Shauna probably knows really well, because I'm one of those people that I continue my education on a regular basis. I think it's really important to continuously, seek knowledge, learn things that you're not doing. So I'm always taking new classes, and I take 6 to 8 week courses on certain things. In addition to and Shauna can attest to this, because she's always like, okay, you can't do everything. But, I have a full clientele list, and I travel a lot for some of my clients. And so like this month, I've got like 3 events that we're doing for clients, three or four events I'm doing for clients. I've got, just today alone, we did 2 press releases. So I'm always looking to figure out, how do I manage my time around all of this? And it is about managing it well. And I kind of try to make sure that I am setting aside enough time in the day where I live by my calendar. I live by, the minute I wake up, I need to place time in there so I can work out, because I enjoy working out, and I need to work out, especially now I'm getting older and I need to
stop it.
I'm still set up. I need to stay fit. So Mama, I need to stay fit.
Please. Okay. Yes, stop it, woman. Okay. You're fit. You look like you're 18 years old. And you probably feel like you're 18 years old. Age is just a number. So you're
not old. I behave like I'm 18 years old sometimes too. So don't, it's
13.
But 13, maybe. But I do. I live by my calendar. And so my calendar is set to, okay, from the minute I wake up. And I also need to add to my calendar, you know, in the morning. I need to, I've got my husband, I've got my kids. I need to make sure that I'm setting aside those times where I am fully present in their lives and making sure that I am giving them the attention that they need, the love that they need. And even my friends, like I try to make sure that Shauna and I have, aside from working together on Life Preservers Project, because it's an important thing for both of us. And I've taken it on because I know how important it is to her.
Right.
So it's important to me as well, not only because of how I feel coming from, you know, I am a minority and I know how human trafficking affects minorities, but also knowing that Shauna has this passion for it. And I want to make sure that what she wants to achieve is achieved. So but all in all, she's also my friend. We've developed a great friendship. She's almost like a sister to me. And so I need to make sure that I set aside that time frame for her. So I look at my calendar. I set aside the time that I need for me time, family time, which includes time with my friends like Shauna and you and others.
Right.
And also setting aside time, knowledge. You know, I need to increase my knowledge, always be increasing that. So I live by a calendar. I live by, okay, what are the things that I need to do and creating habits. And those are the things yes. that I do on a daily basis and making sure that, you know, here is when I wake up in the morning, I wake up at 5 a.m. So at 5 a.m. by 6 o'clock, I'm having my coffee and I'm sitting down with my husband and spending that time with him on a daily basis, just being present with him. There's no phones. There's nothing else. There's just us having conversations. And we wake up every morning to working out and doing those things. And then we spend every night doing the same. So there's an hour in the morning and an hour at night where I dedicate that time to him. And there is an hour where, you know, I dedicate to my friends where I am like, okay, on a daily basis, I do these things. And then I've started a habit now of, you know, my children are older. Unlike you, Nancy, you know, Shauna and I have older children. So my children are in my, you know, my oldest is 31, my youngest is 26. So for us, I try to spend that time dedicated to them, to listening to how they're going about becoming business people and professionals and how they're developing in their professional lives. So I've dedicated a day, an evening on the weekends just to spending time with them and making sure that I'm ever present in their lives with that and doing things like that.
That's so important. And the one thing that I keep hearing from you is living from your calendar, making sure you're scheduling the time and creating those healthy habits.
Yes.
And so Shauna, I guess what is it like for you? How do you remain committed and dedicated, you know, without overwhelming yourself or really getting burnt out?
I do sometimes get burnt out. And it's funny, I'm not a calendar person. I'm a calendar person at work in terms of stuff I need to remember for, like, you know, meetings and junk. But some of what I've done really for probably the past 25 years, because I had my kid young, is I make sure that everything I do interrelates. So while it seems like I'm doing an awful lot all the time, and, you know, I'm back in school, I'm getting my master's in public administration from Seton Hall. I work at the law firm, I run the charity, I run a side business related to the charity, also related to my job. And I still show in galleries, and, you know, now I have an adult son, and his girlfriend apparently has moved in. And so, you know, there's a lot going on in my house. They're in grad school. It's a whole thing. Got the pets and the husband and the life and everything. But what I do is, I truly make sure that all of those things interconnect. And so, right, I'm in school full time, but that's my master's in public administration. It's so I can run the organization correctly, because I can't wing it, right?
So yes.
All the lessons I learned. So, like, for instance, we've grown enough in the organization to where we had to draft a lot of policies and procedures. We had to grow our board. We had to do all these things. Luckily, through the MPA, I have to do all that for school. So I talked to Seton Hall and I said, listen, I need a case study. It's going to be my charity. Mm. And so all the work I'm doing, right, is being for the charity. Everything I produce for the charity, it has also been reviewed by, approved by, and given an A by a professor at the school.
Girl, you're smart.
So I'm producing it together. All of my art shows, everything I do for my art is how I build my collective. All the galleries I show in New York, they're all in our collective. So the networking I need to do to get our artists happens when I show my art.
Right.
And I buy my art, I buy their art, they buy my art, we look out for each other, we you know, take care of each other. So it becomes a true, you know, horizontal democracy of a collective where people work together. And then as a recruiter, as a headhunter, all I do is matchmake all day. I mean, let's be honest, that's what headhunting is. It's just professional matchmaking.
Right.
I do that all day. Those are my donors, those are my influencers. So they all know what I do. They all know on the side what I do. And so, again, I'm taking what I do, every piece of my life interconnects somehow. And also, I'm really rather fortunate. Is when I moved to New York, I almost immediately got into the legal industry. Most of my closest friends happen to be industry. So I'm spoiled. If I go out to an industry event, chances are, while I'm supposed to be networking and doing work junk at this industry event, I'm actually hanging out with all my girlfriends.
That's
smart. I get to see some of the people I love the most, because we all have it. And then they turned into my board. And you said earlier, how do I make sure the board works and stays together? And one of my most important mantras has always been to consider human capital just as that.
Yeah.
And what that means to me is, every moment you're doing something has to be maximized, and it's worth something. It doesn't have to be worth money, but it's worth something. And let's just give it a karma point, whatever you want to call it, it's worth it. And so you have to look at everybody on the board and say, hey, how much time, and I do this to Maribel and Mike Cordero, probably more than everybody else on the board, is you don't have to do it. Like, when stop? Do you not have enough time? Please tell me you have enough time before you do this.
Right.
Please be honest with me about your bandwidth before you do this for me, because I can either A, assign it to someone else on the board, or B, figure out how to do it myself or make my co-founder do it. And so, you know, I try to be very aware as a manager of everybody's abilities in terms of time and bandwidth, and also everybody's abilities. You know, someone might come onto the board thinking they're really suited for one role, and find out during the time on the board that they're not suited for that role. So then I try and give them the freedom and comfort to come to me and say, hey, you know what? This role on the board isn't going to work for me. I don't want to quit. Can I do something else? And
right.
So I'll work with Mike and Maribel and whomever, you know, we're the executive committee. I'll work with Mike and Maribel and we'll figure out how can we allocate this person's desire to still be involved along with what they can do or cannot do and point them in the right direction. And I also think that all of us are busy. So I try to make it to where you're not spending any more than 10%, 5 to 10% of your week on the charity. So I really try, and to the annoyance of everybody, I turn down or shoot down ideas of events and projects in large part because I don't think we have the human capital resources to do it well or to do it in a
right.
way that's fair to everybody involved, long-term thinking about fatigue, both donor fatigue and board fatigue. What is it going to look like long-term if we push for this event this year instead of maybe saying no to this one and looking at something else? And so I try to balance So calendar is not so much my thing, but trying to find interconnectivity right. and balance is
which makes
what
it makes
I
sense.
Do.
When we return,
and I can see now why you and Maribel work well together, because you both have different ways of accomplishing the same thing and you balance each other out, really. You know, she's more structured mm-hmm. in the way that she does it. You're less structured, yeah. but that works together. Because if you were both the same way, who knows what the outcome would be.
We can't run the organization.
When we return, the ladies will talk to us a little bit about the human trafficking crisis and how easy it is for someone to fall victim. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Are you tuned in? Because I am. It's the Nancy Ruffin Show.
I want to shift a little because we've talked a lot about just the I guess, the high level work and the stuff that you're doing with Life Preservers Project. But I really want to talk a little bit about this crisis of, you know, human trafficking and how easy is it for someone to fall victim, to being human trafficked? I don't know enough about this topic, but I've, you know, for the Puerto Rican Day Parade, we were raising awareness on this issue. So I did do a little research, but, you know, I'm really interested in hearing from both you and Maribel. How is it that one would find themselves in that situation? And then how difficult, you know, once you're in it, is it to get out?
Well, I think I'll answer very quickly, and then I'll let Maribel give the example of Susie Perez, what we were talking about earlier. But it is incredibly easy. Any of us could fall into it, into a situation where we wind up being exploited. Whether it be our labor or our sex or whatever the case may be, being exploited is surprisingly easy. People who are manipulative and who know how to do this. Remember, this is $1 trillion internationally industry.
Yeah.
There are experts at how to tap into types of psyches and utilize that and manipulate people and gaslight people into doing and becoming things that they don't want to. The easiest form of exploitation is actually not sex exploitation, it's labor. I think almost any of us can look in our past and say, oh my God, I did things for free that were completely
right.
Someone exploiting me. Like if you're an artist or like a journalist or a photographer, oh, I did that piece for free because they said it would make my portfolio better. And it's very easy to fall into a pattern of continuously doing that because you're being told it will make you better in the end. And that kind of exploitation on that level can happen to almost anyone. But then labor, you know, farm labor, nail salons, masseuse, yeah. All that stuff can explode. But I think Maribel can give an example of a story that's in the news right now of a young woman who lost everything and it was easily changed. So I don't know if you want to tell that story, Maribel.
Yeah. Example. I think a great example is over, and Nancy, you know, you've heard, seen this. I don't think Shauna's seen this yet, but I'm going to share it with her after our call, is Susie Perez. Susie Perez is someone who was a video vixen in the 90s. And she was in a lot of the hip hop videos that were all playing. Beautiful, beautiful woman. And someone had a meme of her in the streets, and she's homeless, living in the streets of New York City. And what happened apparently is her story is that Susie signed with an alleged modeling agency in France and ended up going overseas. And the story is that she was basically doped up and ended up being raped and basically trafficked overseas through this modeling agency. And this is a story that you probably could see because all of these young there are a lot of young women who want fame and fortune and, and they want to do these things. They don't do the background checks. And I have, you know, I have some friends who have been in the modeling industry. I'm sure both of you have as well, who are in fashion and who are famous. And you can fall victim very easily, be you a male or a female, into this industry and wanting to have success. And you are susceptible to these things. But apparently Susie's story is now, you know, she's homeless in the streets of New York City on drugs. And her family's trying to help her, but they found her after years of her disappearing off the face of the earth and no one knew where she was. And I think she's suffering from some PTSD, basically from being trafficked overseas. So this is one of the stories that we can relate to. And it's great that we're having this conversation today, because this brings it to light even more about what's going on in the world. And Shauna and I can talk about this even more because we deal with a lot of the shelters in New York City that help survivors of human trafficking. And a lot of them, you know, you when you think human trafficking, you're thinking about these girls from Russia or Asia who are brought over, but we don't think about the black and brown women in New York City, or even our Caucasian sisters who are being swept off the streets and put into these lives. And I think, you know, Shauna can talk about it more, but when you come from foster homes, broken homes, single parents, things like that, you are very susceptible because you're looking for these, for something.
And you're more vulnerable to be, to this.
To listen. Exactly.
You know, well, I think,
go ahead, Shauna.
There's two ways that it happens. It's the, you know, the shelter system being trans heightens the chances of sex trafficking. What this way, this was Susie Perez was brought in. Unfortunately, you know, the nanny type or, you know, those sorts of things will create trafficking issues. Sometimes not sex trafficking. Sometimes just they get people over here to be a nanny or whatever the case may be, or overseas to be a nanny, confiscate the passport, and that's it. And they don't pay you anymore. And You asked earlier, how hard is it to extract yourself from the situation? It's very hard. You know, the girls at the halfway houses, like at GEMS, those are almost always American girls from generally the Bronx or Queens, who were on the streets. They were in the life, and it can take up to 3 to 4 times to get them out. And there is generally Stockholm syndrome. They're in love with the guy. They're genuinely in love with their pimp. They have been physically and emotionally abused. They are generally whatever age their first trauma started. So if they were sexually abused at 8, if they're 20, they're probably still 8 years old emotionally, because generally, you know, part of the problem with trauma-informed care is you have to understand when the abuse started. And if you don't, if they're really 8, you think they're 16, you got to treat them differently. They're just going to run back to their pimp. The money, they won't make, you know, an example we just heard at a GEMS meeting is the amount of money they make. They're not going to make that again, ever, probably, even if they go back to school. Maybe 1% of them, 2% of them will make that kind of money again. They've got kids. They've got rent. The minute they're off the streets, as we would say, they're not in the life anymore, they're homeless. They're generally abused. Think how hard it is for abused wives who aren't also suffering from PTSD and drug problems to leave. So compound that, and you're like a child.
I want to talk a little bit about how, you know, what the repercussions, if any, you know, are faced by, you know, the pimps or the men or the organizations, you know, that are, I guess, for lack of a better word, recruiting, you know, these women. And the reason why I ask, and Maribel, you mentioned this when we initially got on the phone, Santoya Brown just recently got released from prison, you know, I don't know all of the details behind her case, but I believe it's because she murdered the man, you know, who was continuously raping her. Is that the gist?
No, so sort of. No, she was in the life. He was not her pimp. He was a John.
Okay.
And but it really doesn't matter. The reason she spent so much time in prison is because the safe harbor laws in her state in Tennessee had not been passed yet. There's something called safe harbor laws. They got passed in her case, I think about 6 months after she got sentenced. Had they been passed prior to her sentencing, she would not have been sentenced the way she was. She would have been sentenced for the murder, but it would have been a different kind of sentencing because her circumstances would have been taken into account. So now safe harbor laws exist in most states in the country. I think it's up to like 30 something, 40 states have the safe harbor laws. And that means that the victim of human trafficking is just that. They are a victim. They are not criminalized. It's the user that is criminalized. So whether it be a John or a pimp or in the case of labor, in many states, in the safe harbor states, if though of the past years this has changed, but prior, many of the laws required that the people who hired folks illegally and were forcing them into slave labor conditions would be held financially and if not criminally liable, whereas the folks that were being used for their labor were often not treated as harshly, even if they were here illegally.
Right.
That's obviously changed, not getting into politics, but that's how those laws work.
Well, I think, you know, I want to mention it because I think it's whoever is listening, and from the conversation that we've just been having this evening, it can happen to anyone in any circumstance, any race, any economic status, you know. And I think that as women and as mothers, you know, and as sisters, we have to understand, you know, how this could happen. And then also like educate ourselves, educate the women in our lives to protect ourselves, to protect them. And then understand, you know, if there's any, what the repercussions are, you know, afterwards. Again, this is not something that I know that much about, but I'm interested in learning more because I have, you know, two young daughters. Anything can happen. We never know how life is going to end up, right? And so we never imagine that these horrible things could ever happen to us or to a loved one or to someone, you know, who's close to us. And yet it happens to hundreds of thousands of individuals a year, right? All across the world. And so it's important to have these conversations and have this dialogue and understand what the causes are, how we can combat some of this stuff, you know, and what we can do, you know, individually and as a collective, to kind of eradicate what's happening. Because these numbers, when I was doing my research, it's scary how many people are being human trafficked across the world, not just, you know, in this country, but globally. And so,
it's a billion-dollar industry.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
At the root of it, right? Go ahead, Shauna.
I was a really fascinating comment I heard at this event with people from DHS and counterterrorism and a couple other things related to human trafficking is if you can get them at the money, it will deter it. And so all the big banks, you know, like the KYC, AML, like Know Your Customer, anti-money laundering, all of those things now work. And Maribel can talk a little more about how like technology and AI, big data works, but basically they're able to track off-center, off-kilter transactions and start to track down the money behind the trafficking. When you hit people in the pockets,
right,
it changes their behavior. And right. So if you make it unprofitable,
right,
they'll stop.
Right.
And apparently that's actually probably more than almost any other thing, arresting them or whatever, it appears, is it affecting their bottom dollar?
And that's like anything.
Disrupting in the flow. And, you know, like I said, Maribel, because she just did this course on AI and big data and how that all works, but there are all these like crazy logarithms and AI based stuff that I'm probably miscommunicating about that can track that, the money.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't know, Maribel, if you want to add to that.
Yeah, the biggest problem would probably be now that we have the dark web and things, a lot of things, and I don't know how familiar, you know, your listener base is to the dark web, but the dark web is just this place where you can sell anybody, sadly, anything, but actually you can sell anybody on the dark web, and that creates a huge problem, and that's something that, you know, a lot of regulators and a lot of police officers and FBI and others are trying to get involved in, but that's one area is just the dark web where you can see that things are, because there's Bitcoin now and cryptocurrencies, and you can use cryptocurrencies to buy and sell anything. So that creates another problem because that can't be traced as easily as just having money in a bank. So right. That would be very different. So our dark web creates a whole different area where people have to look into and how those things are done. But as far as our AI algorithms and how those things are done, it's a little easier for us to start looking at using artificial intelligence and other technology to look at those things and understand how people, what people are inputting into databases and people are inputting into social media and other areas so that you can pick up on what they're saying right. and actually filter those things out. So that would be easier for us, but the dark web creates a whole different area because a lot of people are now using cryptocurrency. And that's just a whole nother field where I myself am not familiar with, but I think overall people are looking at the dark web as this place where anything can happen. And of course, trafficking human beings is a huge commodity on the dark web.
Absolutely. I mean,
so that's somewhere else we have to look at.
You know, this part of the conversation really highlights the business of human trafficking, right? Because there's the people component of it, but then it's all driven off of greed, basically, you know, off of this desire to make money and capitalize off of these human beings.
It's an industry. I mean, it is $1 billion. Shauna, you and I have looked at the numbers. It's a $1 billion industry. So you have these people, and even you may have people in politics who are actually using these things to benefit themselves in ways. So, you know, why would they take any other course of action
right.
to go against this than to rather to support it?
It's so common that we don't even think about it. I just came across something yesterday that blew my mind. I thought this was becoming a law, but it's not. But, you know, like in New Jersey, you can hire people with disabilities at what's called sub-minimum wage. So you don't have to pay the minimum wage to do piecework. So organizations, nonprofits, and for-profit businesses alike are using folks with disabilities, and what defines a disability is pretty broad in most states, to do piecework, generally clothing or purses or whatever, shoes, right? All this piecework at sub-minimum wage, which can be sometimes cents on the dollar.
Wow.
And that is a type of trafficking, and that is it's legal. It's completely legal in this country. It's one of the very few forms of servitude that is still legal in this country. And those kinds of things benefit our economy. And when you fight against them, people say, well, if we start paying them minimum wage or more, it's going to hurt our economy. It's right. the same thing with prison labor in this country. There's a huge debate over prisoners are not always paid. There is the California firefighting crew gets paid 5 cents an hour to fight fires, and they are premier firefighters. And they get out because of a law. They can't be actual firefighters. But while they're in prison, these wow. women, some of the top firefighters in California state, but they're at slave labor wages. So there's also economic benefits behind slavery that still exist in this country that make this conversation even darker when you go past sex slavery into human trafficking, labor practices in this country that are prescribed and legal. There's a phrase that says human trafficking is illegal. That's why it's hard. You shouldn't call it slavery, because human slavery was legal.
Wow.
And that is the distinguishing factor.
And I do want to touch upon, I think, because I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, I came across an article where it was pretty big in the news in North Carolina. This young man was working, he was mentally ill and working at a franchise, a large franchise, very well-known franchise. I won't say the name on the podcast, but he was working for a very well-known food franchise, fast food franchise, and he was mentally ill. And because he was mentally ill, they basically did not pay him at all.
Wow.
So this was North Carolina, and they didn't pay him. So I think those individuals, you start to see that, you know, sex trafficking aside, but the labor trafficking piece, you also can take advantage of a lot of those individuals here in the U.S. I don't even want to touch upon like what happens in other countries, but here in the U.S. alone, people take advantage of mentally ill individuals and don't pay them, or individuals who don't speak English very well. Let's talk about that. Who are legal in the States. They may not be immigrants. They may be immigrants, but legal immigrants.
Right.
And they don't speak English very well, so they will take advantage of them and use them and traffic them, basically.
Well, I can give a really sad example of just that. There was, this was a case that was discovered and eventually prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. But about 8 or 9 years ago, I'm sure you can remember them, there was a group of people that would silently walk around on the subways with boxes of like batteries and tchotchkes and stuff that lit up and like yo-yos and all that.
Yes, remember. Yep.
And they were silent. They never spoke, right? They had a sign telling you what they were selling.
Yep.
They never spoke. So it turns out that they were from a remote village. I want to say it was Guatemala. I know it's in South America. They're from a remote village. They were deaf. They were from a remote village. And their form of sign language was incredibly localized. So they had no way of communicating to other people who spoke Spanish, because their sign language was not the same as what Spanish sign language would look like. So no one could understand them. So you had this whole group of people. They were here legally. They had come here. For some reason, whether it was through asylum or something, they ended up in the U.S. legally. They were being exploited by this group of people who were forcing them. They took their passports and were forcing them to sell these tchotchkes and stuff and live in this hovel. It's apparently just depressing. So you can have people that are here legally, but in this case, they were disadvantaged because they had disability, and they had applied to some ad for some sort of work. I think it was this work, but they thought they would get paid. And they never got paid. Also, those people in costume in Times Square, the first wave of them were also being trafficked. The new ones are not, but the first original wave of those Disney characters in Times Square were being trafficked. And I was involved in a program at Hunter where we were going to go see them and take photographs of them. And we were going to call like the Disney parade and everything. And we got told, we couldn't get our permit to do it because that was prostitution. But they knew and were investigating the human trafficking situation they were in for labor trafficking.
Wow. There's so much impact.
So it happens because, right here.
You know, so, I mean, I want to give my audience, the listeners, like some takeaways. What can we do individually, I don't know, like to kind of address this issue, or to bring awareness, or because I think that either directly or indirectly, we contribute to some of this, you know, specifically as you talk about the labor exploitation, right? Because if they're exploiting people for their labor, the public is benefiting from that in some way. You know, so what are some things that we can do as individuals to kind of bring awareness, help this? How can we start to chip away at this problem?
I'll give three examples and then I'll turn it over to Maribel.
Okay.
The first example I think I'd like everybody, all your listeners, to understand is this is an American problem. America is the biggest producer of human and sex trafficking in the country of our own citizens, some of them are in the world, of our own citizens. And it is predominantly Black and brown girls and trans youth. And I think it's really important that we humanize them and understand these are kids generally, or young adults. They are our brothers, our sisters, our queens. These are women who, and men, who are being exploited. They are not just prostitutes. They are not grown people who can make choices. They're just not. And we have to humanize and accept that this is an American problem. It is not the other. It is not people from other countries. It is not the white girl that got a kidnapped and taken or whatever those movies. It's not that. It is this, your sister next door who you grew up with, you love, who's been coerced into a situation that she can no longer leave. So I think empathy and compassion and open-mindedness, get rid of bias, get rid of all that unconscious bias. I think that's really, really important. The second most important thing is if you think you see something that looks like trafficking, report it. There are hotlines for this. The Polaris hotline, please, for the love of God, do not report it to ICE or DHS right now. There is the Polaris hotline, is a national hotline. It goes to trained people and to police who will follow safe harbor laws and regardless of their immigration status, will make sure that they get the medical and physical help, emotional help that they need at that moment. All legal issues get taken care of as a third course. So I think it's really important that people, if you see something, Uber drivers have saved hundreds of girls. American Airlines, through their ambassadors programs, have saved thousands of people. Truckers Against Trafficking, a friend of mine just stopped three women right on the Mexican border from being trafficked because he called the Truckers for Trafficking number. It is imperative that we as citizens stand up and don't hide behind being afraid of finding out whether or not it's a real trafficking situation. Just call the hotline and do the right thing. Fourth, get involved in organizations like ours. Start meeting the people that are living this life and understanding that they are these rich, incredible, generally incredibly strong, vibrant human beings because they are survivors. They've survived something awful and they've come out on the other end, and you meet these people. They are so smart and strong and vivacious and surviving, and they can teach you so much. So I think it's really about humanity and empathy. And then I'll turn over to Maribel other ways that.
I totally agree with everything that Shauna shared. And I want to say that the most important part is within our own communities. Go out. And, we oftentimes say we don't have enough time to do certain things. This week alone, and get involved, like Shauna said, get involved with charities like ours, with nonprofits like ours. This week, our members of our board and their family members and friends and other people from our industry, the legal industry, came out. What we did is we dedicated 4 hours of time to put together backpacks for children. There are over 20,000 children living in homeless shelters here alone in New York City. Over 20,000 children just in the homeless shelters. Wow. Domestic violence and homeless shelters. That's over 20,000. That does not even include children who are living in foster homes, or orphanages or any of those things. So we need to find ways that we can dedicate time to those individuals, show love and appreciation, educate them. Our youth are the most important thing right now in this nation alone. We need to educate our youth. We need to show them love. We need to show them kindness. We need to teach them how to have no bias, right? How to expand on just giving them love and kindness and spreading love all around. And this is something so important that we need right now. And so our organization does things like, for example, we did backpacks this week. We'll continue to do that over the next 2 weeks. We have an art program where we go into some of the we work with New Alternatives and Covenant House and others, and we teach art programs where we can take these individuals, like Shauna said, LGBTQ in community, living in Hell's Kitchen and other places in New York City, and we can teach them art and actually provide them this skill and this place where they can show, you know, they can take what's going on inside and put it into art and express it through art. We have other programs that we're doing, and just working with individuals, like we have a sister organization that we work with that we've just been introduced to for our 10th anniversary, Saving Jane. Saving Jane has a manga comic book. It's not a comic book, I'll say manga, which is a Japanese comic book. And they take this comic book into all of these early childhood centers and all of our youth, right, into elementary schools. And they teach these kids about loving themselves and how to see when something's happening with one of their friends, that maybe something's going on at home and this friend is looking for love in the wrong places.
Right.
And that ends up putting them in these situations where they're susceptible to people who will take them and actually traffic them for various different things, be it labor or sex or whatever it may be, but they will take advantage of them. So we need to find ways to help the youth, especially, like Shauna said, we see a lot. Life Preservers has worked really hard with some of the shelters in the Bronx and uptown New York to make sure that we're providing things back to survivors. And a lot of time these survivors are young girls, 11 years old or older.
Wow.
Who are taken out of situations. Yeah. And they're taken out of these situations and they're coming from single parent homes or broken homes, or they've been abused. And so we need to find ways to show love to these individuals and show them that they're worth something, that they have value. Because the most important thing is to show our kids that they are valued. If we can't show them that, they're going to grow up not understanding that and looking for things in the wrong places, and they will end up in the worst situations.
And so how
I think education is, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Shauna. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think education is key. One of the shelters that we supported for the bulk of our existence is GEMS, GEM Girls up in Harlem. And, you know, they help them get it through high school, college with stipends. And so providing the money necessary to get these girls back into school and get them a college education is critical. I mean, there are now women survivors who are, there's a partner at a big law firm. There is a C-level at, you know, investment bank. So there are survivors out there that, because someone gave them the financial resources, just not enough to be said about the financial resources necessary for the survivors, to help eradicate what's happened to them so it doesn't perpetuate. And education is the key. I think you see that all over the world. Keep our girls educated. Keep our women educated.
Right.
That stops this. It stops the cycle. And it makes sure their daughters or sons don't go into the life.
And so how can people get involved with your organization? And, you know, if there's someone listening right now who, you know, is moved by this conversation and really wants, you know, to get involved, how would they get involved with the Life Preservers Project?
Shauna, do you want me to take that one?
Yeah.
So I will say, Life Preservers Project is on, we have Instagram, we have email, so they can reach out to us at info@lifepreserversproject.org. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. So, and everyone who works for the organization is volunteer. There are no paid employees for Life Preservers Project. Everything we do is volunteer based. And so they can reach out to us and volunteer their services. We're always looking for someone to help in some type of way. We're always doing something within our community. We have, again, Shauna does an art program once a month at some of the shelters in New York City. We have a toy drive we do to help the children in the shelters during the holidays. We've just done the backpacks and back to school supplies, which we do heavily. So we're constantly doing something. We get heavy, you know, donations are always great. So if they want, they can go out to lifepreserversproject.org and make a donation on the website. Or they can just reach out to us via social media. We're on Instagram, we're on Facebook, we're on LinkedIn, we are on Twitter. So we're everywhere. We're putting the word out. They can read some of the blogs that we put out there. We've got people who put out some interesting blogs. And Nancy, we're hoping that, you know, you get involved in that as well.
Absolutely. However, yes, I can help. So we'll talk about that offline, but definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
Yes. But, you know, if they want to write about it, if they want to, any way that they can donate their skills, their value, anything they think that is of value, they can reach out to us and we're happy to have that discussion with them. We've got a lot of organizations who donate their time. You know, right now, like I said, the other day we had our team, a number of our board members went out and did backpacks. This Friday, we have more people who are going out to do additional backpacks. So we've got that going on right now. Art supplies, if they'd like to donate art supplies, because we do programs where we're teaching art. So if they'd like to donate art supplies, they can reach out to us and let us know how, you know, and we can provide them a list of things that they can purchase, or they can make a monetary donation. So there's a number of ways they can get involved, you know, and just spreading a word and doing anything. We can help them get involved. The most important thing, like Shauna said, is if you see something and it does not sit right with you, reach out to us. We'll let you know. Yeah, this is the phone number. Let's make something happen. Let's figure that out. Even if it's if it doesn't sit right with you, then something is wrong. Right. And we need to make sure that we do something about it. We need to tackle that issue.
Right.
My phone number is always available. If you see something and you're like my friend who saw the trucker thing, he was on the road. He's a trucker. He texted me, "Hey, I need to talk to you. Can I call you?" Gave me the scenario. Does this sound wrong to you? I said, yeah, it does. It depends on what side of the border they're on, because it could be legal where they're at. Either way, it's a coercion situation. Make the call. And we work through that. Like, could it have been willing sex workers? Then it's none of our business. But the scenario definitely went the wrong. It was going sideways. The other thing I want to say, in addition to individuals getting involved with us, which is critical, we need corporate sponsors. We'll always look for corporate sponsors. Not only do I teach art, I give away the supplies, because I teach a method of art that teaches coping mechanisms that gives them the opportunity to continue to do it outside of my workshop. So we give them the art supplies to continue that, and that is incredibly expensive. The other thing that I have always, you know, Maribel mentioned Saving Jane. We have always, throughout the course of our existence, collaborated with other like-minded organizations, whether it be Somali Mams organization or Ermi Basuno, like Kolkata, or some local organizations here in the States. We do not believe in hoarding the funders, hoarding the beneficiaries. We want to work together. So if there are other organizations that are listening to us that want to partner with us, we very much enjoy exploring these partnerships and seeing how we can work together to further this, because this is a global epidemic. It's a global war we all have to work together. Yeah. And so I welcome everybody, both, you know, individuals, corporate sponsors, and collaboration. We have to collaborate. We have to work together and share resources. And then the last thing I offer to anyone who's interested is, if you want to start your own organization, I am always willing to help you with at least the initial pieces of advice on how to start a nonprofit, where to go, the resources available to you.
And Nancy, I just want to touch upon something that Shauna just said, is there is a difference between sex work, people who are willing to do sex work, and people who are sexually trafficked.
Right.
So their individuals need to understand that there is a difference. There are individuals who actually enjoy being sex workers, want to do that life.
Right.
That's a job for them. That's what they want to do. And there is a difference between that and being sex trafficked. So it's important to know the difference right. between those two.
Right. Thank you for that clarification. But I want to thank you both for this dialogue. I mean, it was very insightful. You shared so much information that, I mean, you can't pay for all of the information that you guys shared. And Shauna, offering yourself up to anyone that wants to start an organization, be careful what you ask for. You're going to start getting some phone calls.
No, I mean it. I mean it. I think that it's, if you want to start something in this area, if this is, I'm not any kind of nonprofit, but if right. you want to start a nonprofit that focuses on human trafficking or art collectives, and if it's for good, I'll help. I'll point you in the right direction. I there's a ton of resources out there that people, you can't just look it up. I will point you in the right direction. I will help you. I'll review your business plan. If you want to get involved in, you know, this abolition work, if you want to be involved in it and you have a good mission statement, bring that mission statement to me and I'll help. Again, it's a war. We cannot fight it individually, and each individual organization will never be enough.
Right.
So I really want to encourage people who have great ideas to get involved and use those passions and those ideas. Whether you want to come work with us or you want to do it on your own, I'm here. Our entire organization is here to support you in that mission so that we can all do this together.
Amazing.
And I do want to say, Nancy, because Shauna just brought it up and we did not mention this, either one of us did not mention this. So we have a number of New York City artists who actually donate their skills, their creativity, and they donate art to us. We currently have Wavelength Antiques who retrofit antique radios into Bluetooth radios. And we have a number of artists who are working with them to paint the radios and things like that. But we're always looking for artists to get involved if they want to help with some of the classes that Shauna teaches, so that Shauna is not, you know, she's our awesome, inspiring, and creative art person on the board. But if there's someone else who can help with teaching some of those classes and Shauna can show them exactly what needs to be done and we can get them certified, we can do that. If they want to donate art and we can include that, that would be terrific. But I think it's just those things as well. So if you have artists out there who want to donate their skills to us, we are a nonprofit who is also an artist collective, so we'd love to include them in our artist collective.
So there you have it, guys. There's so many ways for you to get involved. There's no excuses. There's financial way. You can make donations. You can go donate your time, your skills, your talent. There's no reason to not get involved. You know, so make sure that you reach out to the Life Preservers Project, to Maribel, to Shauna. They have an amazing team. And I just want to thank you ladies for your time this evening and just for sharing all of this information, valuable information, educating me and educating my listeners. You know, and I know that, and I say this all the time with almost any initiative that I do, you know, individually we can do a little, but together we can do a lot. So if we all come together and, you know, we keep chipping away at this, you know, eventually you know, the hope is that we won't have, you know, this kind of problem, you know, years from now. You know, so with that said, thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
All right. So for my listeners, thank you for tuning in. And as we do every weekend, I want you to go out there, stay focused, and crush those goals.
Thank you for listening to the Nancy Ruffin Show.